Thank you. I now ask Andrew Young, the newest alumnus of Manchester College, to speak directly to those who will join him in a few moments as fellow graduates in 2000.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, and let me say to my fellow classmates of the class of 2000, it sure is good to be here. You earned yours, and I come to say thank you to Manchester College because so much of what happened to me I can attribute to this college, even though I was not privileged to be a student here. You see, I married a young lady from Manchester College, and just about everything that has happened in my life, she was in some way responsible to, for, and overwhelmingly contributed to. When I went back to her hometown saw one of her old boyfriends who hadn't been doing too good, I said, in fact, he was the town drunk. And I said to her, rather conceitedly, "Aren't you glad you didn't marry him?" She said, "What do you mean? If I'd married him, he would have been the ambassador to the United Nations." And so it was almost 50 years ago that I first came in contact with this university and this community. It was not just the college, it was the church. For when I went to visit her in Marion, Alabama, where I was her summer pastor, before she had come home from school, I saw a Bible that was underlined, a Revised Standard Version of the Bible. And in 1952, that was pretty good because it had just come out. I also saw a senior life-saving certificate from the Red Cross and Manchester College. And I saw the books that she was reading, and I decided that the Lord sent me to this godforsaken place in Alabama to find a wife. It took her a couple of years to realize that. Nevertheless, I persisted, followed her to Europe as a brother and volunteer. She finally consented, and we married and had four wonderful children. After 40 years, she was called home to glory to receive a well-deserved award. But it was Fran Thomas, who had been her teacher in high school, who was a student of Manchester many, many years ago, that came south to Alabama and not only arranged for Jean and Cora and Louise to come to Manchester College, but arranged for Coretta King and her sister to go to Antioch. And so all of us were somehow, before we knew it, engulfed in this mission of nonviolent transformation of society, largely by the selection of our wives. And so that's what my message is for you today, that God works in mysterious ways, that there is a purpose for your life, whether you understand it or even agree with it or not. I certainly had no intentions of ending up a politician. And yet, one thing led to another, and before you know it, I found myself in a leadership position. And what's more miraculous? Finding ways to resolve the problems and the conflicts that leadership led me into. And it only gives testimony to the fact that God has a purpose for each and every one of us. And usually, it's a purpose far greater than any you can now conceive or that your parents can imagine. When I was finally sworn in as ambassador to the United Nations, I was sworn in by Judge Thurgood Marshall, who had been a friend of my father's, and standing there with President Jimmy Carter, Thurgood Marshall said, you sure must be proud of this boy. And my daddy's answer was, if he'd have been a dentist, he'd have been somebody. And truly, my father would have been much more proud of me if I had followed in his footsteps. But God had other plans for me that I didn't understand, didn't appreciate, and could not see in advance. And yet I learned with Gene, and I learned in living in relationship to God, as is professed by the members of this church. In fact, I was given two books when I first went to Camp Mack. One was Nehru's book on Gandhi and nonviolence. The other was by a Quaker, Thomas Kelly, called Holy Obedience. And the idea that God has for us some unique purpose is a part of the traditions of our church. But we get so distracted that we actually think we could plan for ourselves better than God can plan for us. But I urge you to restrain your ambitions, to open your hearts, to allow yourselves to be used, and I guarantee you that the future will hold that much more for you. Now, for me, this was a frightening time. I was scared to death at graduation, and I didn't really know why. I just heard yesterday up at Camp Mack a good reason why I was afraid. It was because I could no longer live on college bread. And college bread, I learned, was 4 years of loafing on Dad's dough. And with that coming to an end, it did put the fear of God in my heart. And yet the fear of God led to the love of God and to an openness to God. And somehow the conflicts and catastrophes of the last 40 years have in my life been mostly fun, because I grew up in a Christian tradition where I know we've already won, that Jesus took care of that a long time ago. The only thing for us to do is really play the game right and play it to the best of our abilities. And so I would say to you and guess that some way or other, as though it was not expressed at my graduation, and I don't remember a word that was said at my graduation, so I won't be long because I know you probably won't remember much of this. But it was almost understood in 1951, when I graduated from Howard University, that my life would be dominated by problems of race. W.E.B. Du Bois had said that the problems of the 20th century was the problem of the color line. And so I would say to you that the challenge of the 21st century is the challenge of poverty. For you see, we understood that racism was immoral by 1950. But there were many people who were still trying to justify it, and it took quite a struggle, and it took the death of many people to put an end even to legalized racism in our society. But now it's very hard to find anyone to defend racism. In the 18th and 19th century, there were people who actually defended slavery. But nobody in the 20th century would defend slavery. I would say to you that poverty in the 21st century is as immoral, is as politically problematic and economically stupid as slavery was in the 18th and 19th, and as racism and segregation were in the 20th. But we don't have to have a society where some people are isolated on lonely islands of poverty in the midst of this ocean of material wealth. It's a whole lot easier and cheaper to see to it that people get a good education and become employable and have access to capital and become self-sustaining human beings. It's a whole lot cheaper and easier and more moral to do that than it is to put people in jail. or have them on welfare, or to try to isolate them through a variety of ways. I'm convinced that in the first part of your life in this century, whatever you do, whether you're teaching, whether you're in health, whether you're in business, whether you're in government, whether you're in the arts and sciences, whatever you do, your work will be putting an end to poverty. Because the potential markets of the 21st century are markets that we now designate as poor. I like to tell people, you know, when I came back to the South, everything was run by Sears and Roebuck. And then Sears and Roebuck forgot the poor people in small towns, and they went on to the suburbs and left us behind. And they started trying to compete with Carson Peary and Scott and Saks Fifth Avenue and Macy's and Gimbel's and all of these other big fancy stores. And you don't hear much about Sears Roebuck anymore. But Walmart came in the back door and realized that the poor were potentially rich. And they invested their business in marketing to poor folks, just as Sears Roebuck had done 100 years before. Check out the stock market. See who's doing best in the business today. Whether it's those marketing to the poor in like Walmart or Kmart or the Saks Fifth Avenues and the Neiman Marcuses and the like. Poverty is an underserved market. And as we utilize the full skills of government, of business, and of education, and of religion, we can wipe out poverty in our time. And as we wipe out poverty in America, we can make it possible, I think, for there to be peace on earth and goodwill toward all men, women, and children everywhere. I happen to believe that it's not too much to ask in the 21st century that everybody on the face of God's earth be able to get a clean drink of water. If we can guarantee clean water to the peoples of Africa, it would wipe out 41 endemic diseases and extend their lives to the point where they might have a chance to develop the education and the security to build up the resources to develop that wonderful and enormously rich continent. Oh yes, there's an AIDS problem, but in the back of my mind, I think that even for AIDS, good nutrition, good health, and a strong immune system will help make the African continent even more resistant to AIDS while we're looking for a cure for AIDS. And so I would say to you on the basis of my experience, and I'm going back to my college graduation next year, and it'll be 50 years. And I sat there worried to death, what in the world is going to happen to me? And then the Lord took hold of me, and it's been one miracle after another. I predict, I pledge, I even promise you that it will be the same for you. For God has blessed you with good families, with good education, with a wonderful opportunity and one of the greatest times in the history of humankind to exist. And I know that you will rise far above whatever your expectations and your parents' expectations are at this moment. And the world is going to be a better place because you have been here. God doesn't waste his blessings. To those to whom much has been given, of them is much required. But you know, he cheats. He kind of requires this of you, and then he gives you his grace to give you strength when you're unworthy, to build you up when you're falling down, to be with you in the spirit when you doubt, and to nurse you as a mother nurses a child until you can spread your wings of faith and fly over the horizon of the future and see very clearly your place, your role, and your contribution to this wonderful world in which we live. Thank you very much, and God bless you.